Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture.
Comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends.
Pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason, joined by a special guest today, my broadcast partner of 26 years, I think it is. It has been that long. We did this a couple of months ago where I interviewed John on the Culture Pop podcast. Today we are turning the tables and John Ireland is going to do his best Mike Wallace impression and grill me over everything and everything.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
This is a position I know that you're not always comfortable with, so I hope you're candid.
I'm going to be as candid as I absolutely can. I am a lot of times not comfortable with being interviewed.
I actually think you're going to like it.
Okay.
So let's see how it goes. All right, let me start here. How old were you when you first talked into a microphone? How do you think you got the bug?
You know, when I was a little kid, I didn't have a microphone, but I used to read the sports section out loud to my dad every night. And that was a habit that went on for a few years. And I started reading the whole newspaper out loud at some point. And I always knew I wanted to be on the radio. And so I had a unique idea for a little kid, a 14-year-old or 15-year-old kid. I went to a local radio station called WGOR. And I said, hey, I want to buy 5 minutes of time every afternoon. And I did my little sports show every day, Toledo Sports World. And I sold ads and I was able to pay for the time. And so my radio career actually started when I was about 14 or 15 years old.
Did you take calls?
No, could not take calls. I wrote out a little sports cast for myself. And read it live. It was only 5 minutes. So we did high school sports and we did, you know, University of Toledo and Bowling Green and all the local teams. But yeah, I couldn't take calls at that point.
Okay. So you get on the air as a teenager in Toledo, as you've described. Then did you go back to school? Like, did you finish high school and go to college, or did you have some on-air presence in that market the whole time?
When I went to Bowling Green, I didn't start on the radio, but it happened pretty quick that I got on the radio. There was a station outside of Toledo called WRQN, and it was in Bowling Green, and it broadcast back to Toledo.
Okay.
And I went in and lied my way into the overnight shift at that station.
That's how I started. From my first shift at the UCLA campus station was from 3 to 5 a.m. So you were on like midnight to 5 kind of thing?
Yep, midnight to 6 a.m. Every night. And when I took that job or convinced them to take me, I had never been a DJ before. I had never spun records, never played music and done the DJ thing. So I completely made it up.
I did the same thing.
Yeah.
I lied and said, oh, yeah, I've done this for a long time. I know exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, and the lesson here, kids, is if you want to work in radio, lie.
Hey, by the way, and I don't know why I've ever asked you this. Why Bowling Green? You had really good grades. You had an insane SAT score. What was your SAT score?
My SAT score was 1450.
Okay, which is you would have been the highest SAT score at my high school, and I went to a big high school. So you ace the SATs. You, I think you told me you got into Yale, correct?
I did. I got into Yale Drama School, Northwestern, and Bowling Green.
Okay, was the Bowling Green thing, the reason you went to Bowling Green, financial?
It was financial. I had been given, when I was a junior in high school, Bowling Green ran a contest statewide to find the outstanding high school junior in the state of California. And the winner got a full scholarship to Bowling Green, full academic scholarship. And I won that award when I was a junior. And in my parents' mind, that meant college was all done. He's going to Bowling Green. We don't have to pay anything. Meanwhile, I was still aiming at Yale and at Northwestern. And in the end, Which Tom Cruise movie was it Risky Business where he says at the end, "What the fuck, Illinois University?"
Yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of my attitude. Of course, he ended up in the Ivy League, but that was my attitude. What the fuck, Bowling Green University?
Now, you have two brothers. Where are you? What order do you go in age? Are you the oldest, youngest, or middle?
I am the oldest. I have one brother who's a year younger than me and one brother who is coming up on 50. So he'd be 5 years younger than me.
Okay, so that in this particular case, that worked against you because you were the first one in your family to go to college. And your parents, like, you couldn't make the argument that Brian or Travis was already in school because you were the test case, right?
Yes, I was the first, and nobody in the family had ever been to college. And we did not come from a well-off background. You know, we were lower middle class to middle class. And when my parents saw full academic scholarship, that was pretty much it in their minds.
Okay, so you go to Bowling Green. And are you on the radio while you're in college?
Yeah, so I was on the radio starting when about the end of my freshman year. That's when I started doing overnights at WRQN. And then after that, I got moved to Morning Drive about the time I was a junior at Bowling Green. And I was working with a girl named Pam Gilbert. The show is called Mason and Pam. And it was... It did well. I mean, we weren't knocking the world over, but
let me back up a little bit because I missed an obvious question here. You've always been Mason on the air because, as you've talked about openly on our show, that's not your given name. Has that always been your on-air name? Like, even when you were in high school, were you Steve Mason?
When I was high school as a student, I was Steve Mashonsky. But when I was on the radio, I was always Steve Mason. And I picked that name just because it was simple and catchy. And the program director at the first station I worked at said, yeah, you can't go on the air with a name like Mashonsky. If it was today, I would have kept that name. I think it's distinctive and interesting. And I think the world has changed. You don't have to have a generic radio name anymore.
Yeah, the funny thing is people think that because Ireland is such an unusual thing to have for a last name, people think that I'm the one with the fake radio
name. That's so funny.
They think I of the two of us, they think that I'm the one with the fake radio name. They also think if they've heard one of us is gay, they're convinced it's me because my tastes are way more gay than yours, strangely.
Well, I used to have that question. I think I've said this before, but I had a couple people come up to me when we were first working, and they asked me, hey, you can tell me, is Ireland gay? I was like, no, he's not. And you are just missing the forest for the trees right now.
Right. Well, I always used to say, before you were comfortable coming out, that if anyone ever tried to out you, that I would be so offended by it that I would then take the hit.
Yes.
Just to cover for you. But it as it turns out, it just never came around and then you comfortably came out later. So it wasn't a card that either one of us ever had to play. But that is funny that people would ask you if I'm gay.
Yeah, yeah.
You're on Morning Drive doing Mason and Pam in Toledo. You get out of Bowling Green and then you just keep rolling with that morning show.
I got out of Bowling Green and I decided I wanted to work in the movie business. And so I got a job as a PA on a movie called Monkey Shines, which was shooting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is where my parents were living at that time. And it paid all of $500 a week. It was 6 days, 6 days a week. Sometimes it was like 13 days on, one day off. I was basically picking up trash and garbage. But I had a generally good time with it and thought, okay, maybe someday I want to be an assistant director or a director, or I want to get in front of the camera or whatever that is. And in the end, I wound up moving to California in 1987. So it would have been the fall after I got out of Bowling Green to pursue a career in production on the film side.
I never knew that. I thought you the first time you moved to California was when you came out to do Extra. How long did you live in California in 87?
I lasted about 7 months. A writer strike hit, and so everything got shut down. But I had some cool jobs in the meantime. I worked on a TV series called The Highwayman, which was about a flying semi-truck. It starred Sam Jones and Jacko, who is the Energizer battery guy from that period of time. And then I worked in a casting office where I was like, it was the weirdest thing. Like, it was just one guy and me, and he was casting a movie called Personal Best, and he had Martin Sheen attached. And he said, now you have to go and fill out the rest of the cast. And so I was authorized to write offers. Like, you're allowed to write an offer for this amount of money for this role. And I ended up putting together a really good cast. If you look at this picture on IMDb, I had Scott Glenn, Sharon Stone, F. Murray Abraham, and Christian Slater. Those are the people that I picked out to play those roles. And I met Budget, but it was the weirdest thing. He said, oh, yeah, you like this Sharon Stone? She'd just done her first movie. And I was like, yeah, I think she's going to be something. Okay, write her an offer. Wrote her an offer. All of a sudden, Sharon Stone has signed on. It's the weirdest thing. I had a really weird, surreal lunch with F. Murray Abraham, who won the Academy Award for Amadeus. And we were trying to talk him into doing this job. It was 3 days shooting for $100,000. And finally, we convinced, it was me and this guy named Joseph Perez, who was running the company, talked F. Murray Abraham into doing the role for $100,000. But it was like a surreal job. I was 1 year removed from college, and now I'm writing offers to actors to play in this movie. It was a really weird time.
Why did you go back to Ohio?
The writer's strike hit, and all of a sudden, everything completely shut down. And I thought, okay, I'm going to stick this out. And that's where I have I get pissed off when I hear about Applebee's, because I thought, all right, I'll just get a job as a waiter. And I went in and applied for a job at Applebee's, and they saw my college degree, and they saw the things on my resume, morning drive radio, all that stuff. And they were like, well, you're way too qualified for this. We can't hire you. So Applebee's did not hire me, which pisses me off to this day. And I ended up coming back from Los Angeles and literally going right back into morning radio.
So was there a layoff? Once you got back into town, they were familiar with your work and they just said, okay, we'll give you the morning show back?
I'd stayed in contact with the ownership of that radio station, which was a standalone FM. And I talked to them for, like a month leading up to when I was going to leave Los Angeles. And ultimately, I knew I had the job by the time I drove back to L.A. And as I remember it, I got out of that long car ride on a Saturday, and I was back on the air on a Monday on WRQN in Toledo.
All right, so you go to Toledo, and that's when the show kind of takes off, right? You guys were able to get ratings, and you had I'm guessing this was your first taste of real radio success.
Yeah, this was it, and it was really fun. It was a golden time in my career, because I was also I was doing mornings, and I was the program director. I had total and complete authority. I had the con, as they would say. And it was my station to do with whatever I wanted to. I had the complete trust of ownership. And the morning show started really clicking. It was with a girl named Diane Scribner, who was my girlfriend at the time. The station, I was programming it. I was choosing the music. I was creating the promotions. I got to do the entire thing. And it was a fantastic time. And the station completely blew up. I mean, blew up. We were doing like 34 shares with 18 to 49s. I mean, it was just like, it was pinball numbers in Toledo.
All right, so you're killing it in Toledo, and then you get a call and you get a job offer in Los Angeles. Now, you've already lived in L.A., which I didn't know until now. You have to make a decision. Do you leave this kind of radio Camelot that you've built to take this job in LA. Was that an easy decision or a hard one for you?
Well, I mean, it was a complicated decision because all of a sudden in the fall of 1992, I showed up at work one morning to do the morning show, and there was somebody strange in the program studio that was playing the song Louie Louie by the Kingsmen over and over and over again.
Format change.
And because they had gotten wind of the fact that I was looking at other markets, and they figured once I left, what were they going to have? So they switched to oldies. And at that point, John Lynch reached out to me. And the main reason he reached out to me, John Lynch was the owner of the Mighty 690 and the Noble Broadcast Group. He owned a station in Toledo.
Okay. And most people that are listening to this would know John's son, who is the former NFL player who is now the general manager of the 49ers. John's dad, John Sr., was the guy who brought you to Extra in San Diego, correct?
That is correct. And the only reason, I firmly believe, the only reason he hired me, they had a station in Toledo called WMHE, and it was a top 40 station like mine was. And we were absolutely destroying them. We were cleaning their clocks. And John Lynch, I really think, hired me to come to work for the Mighty 690 only to get me out of Toledo. I don't think he necessarily saw that I had great potential as a Southern California personality. He just said, I just want that guy out of Toledo. He's killing my station. So that's why right. I took the job with John Lynch.
Did you ever go back and see if that tactic by Lynch worked in Toledo? After you left, did his station catch your old one?
His station blew up at that point. It really was. I mean, okay. In all humility, I was running that station, and I had a vision in my head, and I was a dog with a bone. I worked, I worked 12 hours a day without even thinking about it. As soon as I left, our station fell apart and his station blew up.
Okay, so you come to California, and for whatever reason, matter of fact, somebody just wrote about this in The Athletic. They wrote an oral history of Extra Sports 690. For whatever reason, the first year at Extra was hard for you, that for whatever reason things didn't work. What do you remember about that first year?
They stuck me with the leftover part of the last morning show. So it was the Butts Brothers was the name of the previous morning show. So it became Steve Mason and Dan Butts, who was a totally nice guy, but just not a radio personality. And I lasted, I think it was 6 months. I went home to see my family, and somebody called me and said, Fritz Quint. Do you remember Fritz Quint?
Yeah, media columnist for the San Diego Union-Tribune.
He, while I was out of town on vacation, wrote a column that said they were pulling me for morning drive. I was like, oh, nice way to find out. Nice way to find out. I'm at home. I'm with my family, and I find out this article runs in San Diego. But at that point, my attitude was, all right, it didn't work. Just tear up my contract. Just tear it up. Let's go back to square one. I'll go back to Toledo. I'll go back to programming my radio station, and let's call it a done deal.
All right. So this is when you and I kind of cross paths. Now, my version of how we met is that I was doing TV in San Diego, but I was doing fill-in work at Extra.
Right.
I got a call from Howard Friedman, and he said, we want to put you on at night with Steve Mason. He's kind of mailing it in, but he's funny. We want to see if you can goof around with him. And when I walked in, you had your head down, and you were typing on a computer. I think you were writing a screenplay.
I was. I was writing a screenplay.
But we hit it off.
Yep.
Kind of ignored that we were on the radio and kind of did what we're doing now. We just started like talking to each other and it clicked. What is your version of that story? What's your recollection of how we first got together?
Okay, so my version is that I was working nights with a guy named Rick Schwartz, and I was writing a screenplay. And we would come on after Kings hockey. The Kings were on a run that year, and we do kind of like Kings postgame because, you know, that's my area of expertise. and that's when I started writing the screenplay. Now, Rick was gone for a week, and they brought you to fill in for Rick. And I was like, you know what? I think there's a show here. I had fun working with you. And I knew, I put in my head, someday I'd like to do a show with him. So what really happened was, do you remember the 10-year contract? Actually, no. Do you remember him chasing me, this is John Lynch, around the Christmas party to try to get me to sign a deal?
Well, at this point, you're still under the original deal that they brought you out on.
No, the deal was coming to an end. The deal was coming to an end. And all of a sudden, John was like, you know, I really like this kid. I want to put him in morning drive. And I said, nope, I'm not staying. I'm leaving California. I'm going back to Toledo, and I'm going to whoop your ass. John was literally chasing, and he's a crazy son of a bitch. He was chasing me around that Christmas party trying to get me to agree to move to morning drive. And instead, I took nothing. I didn't take a job. I didn't go back to Toledo. I took 6 months off saying, you know, I'm still young and I've got time. I've got free time. There's other stuff I want to do. So I took 6 months off. Then when they hired me back and we stayed in touch that entire time, they convinced me to come back and do mornings. They said, who do you want to do mornings with? And I said, there's only one person that I will do it with, and that is John Ireland. That's my recollection of how it went down.
Yeah, that all sounds right to me too. Now, when I look back on our first week, and you may have had a better understanding that shows need to kind of ramp up and grow, but I thought our first week was unlistenably bad. I just thought it was terrible. I was dating Lisa at the time. We weren't even married, and I came back and I said, "Boy, I don't know what happened." But the whatever we had bottled up on that night show isn't there in the morning. And after two or three days, I had serious doubts that this was going to work. Did you look at that when you look back at that first week, or did you know it's just part of the process and we'll be fine?
Well, because here's the thing. We knew that like the last five morning shows at that station had flopped. So
right. And we were coming in after the worst one, like the worst one had. Berger, Prescott, and Schwartz.
Yes.
Rick had gone to that, and Berger and Prescott were a 91X show that had been successful, but they shotgun marriaged the three of them, and it just didn't work. So with that helped us.
Yeah, that did help us, and I think we went into that show with the idea that we were going to flop too, that like the other morning shows, that ours wouldn't work either, but that we would get a big cushy buyout at the end of it. Because remember, we joked openly on the air about who knows how long we're going to be here, and we just are here for the big cushy buyout, which you know, it seems self-destructive. But I think we were kind of joking about it. I think all shows take some time to sort of hit a groove, and it took us a little bit of time. I don't remember it being struggling for that long. I mean, I think within a couple of weeks we had it and we knew we had something.
Yeah, we did. But I, in the first 2 weeks, had said, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? And then it got way better. Matter of fact, when I look back on that, when I knew it was going to work, and you may have had a better idea earlier than this, but I think we came on in the summer of 94.
Yep.
And in January of 95, like right around the end of that, the Chargers made the playoffs, and they were pretty good. They had a good team that year. We were the Charger station. We had Bobby Ross, the coach, on every week. We had done a lot of Charger-related promotions. And you and I came up – we haven't talked about this for a long time. You and I came up with the idea of, okay, we're going to do a scavenger hunt, and whoever comes up with all 10 items will send them to the AFC Championship game in Pittsburgh.
Right.
The Chargers were in Pittsburgh, and they were heavy underdogs, and nobody thought they were going to win. And so you and I came up with 10 things. You, as you mentioned, you had family back there. And we came up with 10 things that were germane to Pittsburgh that no one would ever be able to get. And this was before the internet. You couldn't go on the internet and like look this up or have it sent to you.
Amazon. None of that stuff was available.
Stuff existed. We had a Clark bar on there. We had a Bobby Vinton album. We had something, any type of thing from Permanti Brothers,
yep.
which was a sandwich place in Pittsburgh. And when we showed up to work the next morning, you and I thought, well, if somebody comes up with 9 out of 10, they'll probably win it. And we showed up to work the next morning, and there were probably 75 to 100 people that had all 10. And I still, Mace, don't know how they did it. After talking to a couple of them, what we forgot was that we were on a morning show. Anybody who had family in Pittsburgh just called their family and said, put it on a plane.
Yeah.
Put it on a regular plane, and they all went and met the plane at LAX, and all of a sudden I thought, oh, God, we've got something. And we got in big trouble because, as usual, we didn't clear it through promotions.
Yeah.
And do you remember who kind of went to bat for us and saved us?
It was Janet Nauman, who went on to be Jim Rome's wife.
Correct. Janet was our human resources person, and they wanted our heads. And people were mad at us, and Janet said, hey, you guys are looking at this completely the wrong way. We've got 100 people in our parking lot. We've got lightning in a bottle. Newspapers and TV stations are going to cover this. You guys, and she liked us.
Yeah, she did.
You know, we all got along. We liked Jim, and Jim had a rivalry with Chet and Hacksaw, and so we were Team Rome. And Janet totally looked out for us. As a matter of fact, I ran into her at a Laker game 4 or 5 years ago, and I'll never forget that you know, we could have been in legal and been in trouble, and she kind of she was our protector in that scenario.
Yes, she was. Yeah.
All right. So we get it together. We have a good run in mornings, and then they come to us with this idea for the triple cast that we're going to be on 690 and 1150 in the morning, and we're going to go on TV to go on Fox Sports West 2, which was a TV now, it's now Prime Ticket.
Yep.
That we're starting for the Dodgers. And I thought we did it for 18 months. We did that triple cast. That's about as much fun as I've ever had. What's your recollection about the triple cast?
It was a blast. It was such a weird show. I mean, it was just really, really weird. I mean, we would go to commercial breaks and we were playing wiffle ball and we were throwing a Nerf football around and, you know, we were making fun of everybody we worked with and vice versa. And I mean, it was a really, really fun stretch of time. And weird stuff happened during that stretch, too. You know, I always say that when bipolar disease, you've got your highs and you've got your lows. When I would get high, I would do the stupidest stuff. And and that's where that jumping over the bar came from.
Explain that story to people that have never heard it. Then go on YouTube and watch it. I'm still embarrassed by how both me and Ray Allen, the great NBA player who was in studio that day promoting He Got Game, we totally downplayed it. We thought you just sprained your ankle. But back up and explain what happened that day.
Okay, so on that day, there was a stunt bicycle guy that came in, and he was bouncing his bike on the back wheel. And he would bounce it, and he would bounce over this really high bar. And I looked at the bar and said, I'm pretty sure I can jump over that. I'm pretty sure I've got this. And keep in mind, at this point, I'm, you know, cycling really high in terms of bipolar disease. So I think I can do anything. And I decide I'm going to jump over that bar. And I took a couple of cracks at it. And I decided somehow that it was my shoe that was the problem.
Doc Martens on, and you thought they were too heavy.
If I just remove the shoes, I think I'm going to clear it. And I jump the bar, come down crashing on the heel bone, which is called the calcaneus, and it just shattered instantaneously. And then, as every red-blooded American male would do, I stood up to say, "Oh, see, I'm fine. No worries." And when I did that, all the pieces of the calcaneus bone sort of spun like a Rubik's cube. And that's when I hit shock. The pain, I remember very little about it except for you and Ray Allen kind of laughing about it, saying it was a sprained ankle. And I was in emergency surgery, I think, 3 hours after that show ended.
And then you had a pulmonary embolism in the hospital, and you were in the hospital for over a week, right?
Yeah, I was in the hospital for a week and a half because, yeah, when I was on the operating table, I had a pulmonary embolism, which is, you know, like crazy serious. And I mean, it was a hellacious experience. It was hellacious. But it's fun to talk about now.
Yeah, boy, I'm very glad that wasn't worse. That story could have ended much differently.
Yeah.
All right, we're doing well. We're having tons of fun, and then the radio station starts jerking us around a little bit. They don't know what they're going to do. They get mad and end the TV portion of the show because they said we were doing too much TV and not enough radio.
Yes,
which I still disagree with. I don't think we ever changed the tone or the content of the show. Did you?
No, I didn't either. I thought it was some weird Jack Evans was the guy we were working with.
Right.
And
that was the era.
He got it all wrong.
All right. So then, we have a good 5-year run, and you in the middle of all this, when they're not telling us what they're going to do, they're not offering either one of us much. You get a call to do mornings in New York.
Yes.
And you take, was that a hard decision?
Well, I thought I had flown to New York earlier that year and met with the executives at WNEW, which at that point was a classic rock station and like a heritage classic rock station in New York City. Right. First station to play the Beatles in America. I mean, like really hardcore. And they said, we're going to flip this thing. Opie and Anthony were doing afternoon drive. And they were looking for somebody to do mornings. And they had I was interested. I was interested at that point. It would have been fall of 98 when I actually got very, very serious about the job. And I told the guy we worked for, a guy named Mike Thompson, that here I've got this offer from WNEW in New York, but I'd really like to stay. What can you offer? And he offered me, and I shit you not, he offered a 6-month contract.
Oh, wow. That made it easy.
He said, this is going to be a leap of faith for you, but someday we'll laugh about it. And I said, dude, I have got a 7-figure offer on the table from New York City, and there is no way I'm staying for a 6-month contract. So reluctantly, I went to New York.
Okay, so yeah, that kind of worked itself out. So then you go to New York. You only lasted 18 months there. Why didn't it work in New York?
I often ask people. We had Judy Gold, the comic, on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I said, was that show any good? Because I really don't remember. I think of it fondly now and think that it was good, and it was more a function of what was going on inside my head that colored everything. John, you know, when I will randomly say off the air, boy, that's the worst show we've done in a long time. That show really sucked. And you'll say, no, that show was fine. I mean, and I react emotionally to things. I was having a complete bipolar meltdown at that point. That was my big come to Jesus. Let me try to figure out what's going on with this. I had my shrink on the phone 3 times a week. We were playing with medications. I was doing the show and I was grinding away at it and working way, way too hard on it. I was completely obsessed with the show. And in a way, I never really got to fully enjoy living in New York because it was such a grind for me. And because my state of mind was because I was down like I was.
Right.
I never really fully, and I often wonder what would have happened if my meds were right and I'd stuck it out and we'd gotten over the hump. And if all that stuff had happened, if it would have been a good show. There was a point at which we were nominated for Best New York Morning Show along with Don Imus and Howard Stern. So there were some people that thought the show was good. In the end, it just ground me down and I came home in a terrible depression.
Okay, so 18 months in New York, you come back and you take a job in San Diego and I'm doing TV in LA. And a guy named Ray Calusa, Hail fellow well
Hail
met.
Hail fellow right? well met. Yeah, great guy.
It was like the healthiest guy we knew, and tragically died of a heart attack when he was driving. One of the weirdest things ever.
Yeah.
Ray offers to put the band back together at KSPN. And I didn't think he was a fan of our show when we did it for those 5 years before you went to New York. And I didn't think it was all going to work out. You had a verbal agreement to do a show in San Diego, but they didn't give you a contract. I've often wondered, you know, talking about sliding doors, had they given you a contract, does Mason and Ireland at KSPN ever happen? I'm not sure they would have let you out. What do you think?
They would have never let me out. John Lynch was a complete hard ass. Had I signed a contract with 1090 down in San Diego, I would probably, I mean, potentially would still be there. Because one of the things that he was putting into that deal was to be one of the play-by-play guys for the San Diego Padres, who they had just gotten.
So, which is close to your heart.
Which is really close to my heart. And so had I started that job and had I has signed a deal which included play-by-play for the Padres on some limited basis, I probably would have never left. I might be Ted Leitner right now doing Padres games. But in the end, yeah, he never, ever would have released me from that contract under any circumstance.
Do you think they thought that – did they know they didn't have you under contract? It seemed weird to me that – you were, for lack of a better word, available. They knew you and I had history. They knew you and I had ratings. You know, they had to know that at some point somebody was going to come after us. Did they just drop the ball?
You know, I asked about it all the time. That's the frustrating thing was I would say, guys, look, if I'm going to work here, I want to make a life down here. And that means I want a contract. And They kept fumbling it. They never got to the point where they actually offered me a contract until 3 days after I told them that I was leaving. Then they offered me a contract. But I had no deal, and I was frustrated that they hadn't given me a deal.
All right, so they don't give you a deal. They put you and I together, and we put the show back together, and it's going well, and they're moving us around, and we have a run. And then the maddest I've ever been at you,
mm-hmm,
is when you found out I was getting fired and you didn't tell me. Mm-hmm. I really thought I would never forgive you for it. And strangely, you are the one who fixed it. You may have been the only one who could, but you were the one that put Humpty Dumpty back together again. So I don't know if I've ever asked you this. How hard was it for you not to tell me?
I was just miserable. I was miserable. And they told me, you know, and they should have never put me into the situation in the way that they did. But they told me 2 months beforehand what they were going to do. They were going to put me on middays, and they were going to put Dave Damashek on afternoon drive. So I knew this was all coming. And the closer and closer it got, I struggled with my conscience was really, really messing with me. And the day finally came, and somebody stopped in and said, "Hey, can we see you after the show?" Said to you.
Right.
And at that point, I just looked at you and said, "You're getting fired."
Right. I got like a 15-minute heads up. But you're right. That ship had already sailed. But I often think that, you know, I was so mad at you, and I was mad at Dave Singer. And that was the moment for me that, and I had come and gone from a lot of jobs before, but that was the moment for me when I realized it, you know, there's that line in Jerry Maguire, it's not show friends, it's show business.
Yeah, right.
Because you're right, they never should have put you guys in that spot, but they did. So they revamped the radio station, and Damashek's doing afternoons and you're doing middays.
And it was a disaster.
Yeah, I've moved on. In my head, I'm thinking, you know, this is just, you live and learn. And, you know, I'm doing TV and I'm doing sidelines for the Lakers and I'm having fun. And one day, I can't remember if you called me or texted me and you said, "This is going worse than I can possibly describe. If I could put the show back together, would you do it?" And I said, "Let's talk." And you and I kind of got on the phone and talked for an hour and made up and got everything going. How did you do that? Because the same executives that blew it up were the ones who put it back together. And those guys just traditionally will never admit they're wrong. Are you surprised you were able to pull that off?
It was, you know, I was pushing, first of all, I pushed against it when they had the idea in the first place to have me do a solo show and bring in Damashek. I'm like, what are you guys doing? You're going to try something brand new here. You're going to ruin what potentially has taken years to build. So I was already sort of building that bridge even before it happened. And ultimately, it was between Bob Kuntz and who was the program director? Bob Kuntz was the general manager. Was it Larry Gifford?
Yes.
Larry Gifford. And I mean, I'll say here, Bob told me once he loves firing people. And I thought, what kind of person loves firing people? I just think that's a terrible thing to say. And
Bob was a sales guy who was a really successful sales guy. And he's not a bad guy. And by the way, I want to back up a little bit. We both really like Damashek. Still do.
Oh, Damashek's great. Yeah. It was they screwed him over. They put him on and said, just don't do any sports. And that wasn't the right move for the station. Again, that was bad visioning on the part of Bob Kuntz and Larry Gifford.
Yeah, I was really surprised that you were able to put it back together, and then you did. That was in around
2004.
No. 2004 is when we started. 2008 is when they blew it up.
Oh, right.
And when the Lakers and Celtics met in the finals, the one that the Celtics won in 2008 was right when they put us back together. And then we've been on the air consistently ever since. That was 12, 13 years ago. And now people that listen to the show, that's the show we've been doing, albeit in two or three different buildings. But that's the show we've been doing that they hear now.
Yep.
All right. So let me pivot to your personal life, which I find funny because when I first met you, a kind of a mantra of yours was, let's keep our personal lives personal. Do you remember that?
I do.
You had a running joke of, John, you have my phone number, but you don't have the inside line.
Correct.
So we did a lot of joking about it, but eventually we kind of got more comfortable, and now we literally talk about everything. So how old were you when you knew you were gay?
I probably knew... God, I probably knew when I was 12 or 13 years old.
And did you tell anybody?
No, nobody. I thought the world would fall apart if I ever made that sort of announcement.
When and how did you tell your family, and how did that go?
Well, let's see. In about 92... I met my first boyfriend, and I thought, all right, so now's a good time to tell my parents because at least they know. I mean, in my head, I'm thinking, at least they won't think he's all by himself or he's got nobody to deal with this with. So I had my first boyfriend at that time, serious boyfriend, and I told, was back in Ohio and told my mom. And my mom... First of all, I told her while she was driving, which was a terrible mistake on my part.
Oh, gosh.
Secondly, she did not believe me. I mean, we prank a lot in our family, and she absolutely did not believe me for a few hours until I finally said, no, I mean, really, this is completely not a joke. This is 100% real. And at that point, she got a really sad look on her face, and she said, is it something we did? And I thought, oh, that's so sad. That's so sad. It was nothing. Obviously, it was nothing that they did.
And then did you tell your dad or did your mom tell your dad?
I think my mom told my dad. I don't think I ever had that conversation. Although my dad grew to be okay with it, I don't think he was ever fully okay with it.
Yeah, well, that's hard for people of their generation because, you know, like I was watching Rocket Man the other day and, you know, it was horrific, the things that Elton John's mom used to say to him.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully, you know, times have gotten better, which kind of leads me down the road where I want to go with you. What finally gave you the courage to come out? What changed? Because I know for a long time, this was my biggest secret, that you were gay. I knew for years. I didn't even tell Lisa for 2 or 3 years until, you know, my wife, Lisa, she's sure. Like the world positive person. And she kept trying to set you up with women.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, I'm going to have to trust you with something that I'm not comfortable sharing with anybody. But here's the deal. What finally got you to the point where you said, okay, I'm going to start telling people. And then eventually that led to you coming out on the air. What got you there?
So I think that the let's keep our personal lives personal was yeah. just a way for me to keep everybody at arm's length so that sure. nobody, so that you couldn't, you didn't know I was gay, so that the people I work with didn't know I was gay, all that stuff. So that was why let's keep everything personal. At some point I realized, and a lot of it comes from like listening to somebody like Howard Stern on the radio, who just says everything on the radio.
Yeah,
whatever's in his head, whatever's going on in his life. And in my head, I thought, I will never really be a great radio personality until I let all this stuff out on the air. So that was sort of the long-term mission. But it happened really, really slowly. And, you know, for gay people, there are different levels of coming out. Like, for example, there's coming out to your parents. It's a really tough one. There's coming out to your friends, which can be really difficult. Then you come out to your coworkers, and that can be difficult. And then I added that extra layer of coming out publicly, which weird was, by the time it happened, I didn't know exactly how it would go, but I wouldn't say it was the scariest one. I would say the scariest one was telling my parents. That was the one that scared sure. me the most.
Well, you didn't want to disappoint them or crush them, and then your mom says, did we do anything wrong? So, you know, that part of what you were most worried about came out right away.
Well, here's how bad that was for me. I just assumed, I went on the assumption that when my parents found out that they would disown me. That was just, in my head, that was the way it was going to go down no matter what. And so I decided the way that I could not be disowned is if, before I tell them, I buy them a house. So I worked my ass off to be able to buy them a house. And after they had the house, I came out to them and I was like, in my head, I was like, well, what are they going to do? I just bought them a house. Like they're going to have to be okay with me. They can't possibly disown me because they're living in a house that I bought. So in my head, that's the way my brain was working. I was assuming when I was a kid that it was going to be just a really, really rough life. And to put it into context, you know, this was happening. I graduated high school in 83, and I remember in 1982 watching the nightly news with Tom Brokaw, and Tom Brokaw talking about the gay cancer. And so in my head, it didn't even have a name at that point. It didn't even have the name. It wasn't called AIDS. But I, all of a sudden, in my little kid head, my little junior in high school head, I was thinking, God, here I am. I'm in high school. I've never had sex with anybody. And now I'm going to get this thing called the gay cancer. And I thought my life was just totally doomed there, because there was no indication that it had anything to do with sexual contact at that point. It was just cancer happening with gay men. So right. I was terrified the entire time. And you talk about sliding doors. I mean, I've always thought that. So it came down to, we talked about this earlier, Bowling Green or Yale Drama School. And the year was 1983. I ended up going to Bowling Green. Had I gone to Yale Drama School, I probably would have come out. I was an actor. I very well could have gotten sick. because I had become sexually active there. Instead, I went to Bowling Green, ended up in a fraternity and the president of the fraternity and the interfraternity council and did all that stuff, what I would call like classic straight guy stuff. And so sliding doors was I ended up coming out a lot later in life, but maybe that protected me from getting sick at a time when a lot of people were getting sick.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. How did you meet Juan, your partner? And you used to joke to me all the time that you never had a relationship for more than a year. With Juan, you guys have been together for years and you seem really happy. How'd you guys meet and why do you think it's worked as well as it has with him?
Well, yeah, we've been together for 14 years. I met him on New Year's Day at a place called Casa del Mar in Santa Monica, beautiful hotel, restaurant, lounge kind of place. And I had just done a Chargers-Broncos game, the last regular season game of the year for Westwood One. And I had been doing the on-field stuff, the player interviews and all that. And I was soaking wet because it had rained all day. And I was just getting home to Venice, and I thought, you know, I'd stop off somewhere, get a hot cup of coffee and clear my head. And I had had I was on a terrible losing streak with guys, just like flaky and weird. And you met one who turned out to be a stalker. And I mean, there were some losers in that group. And that day is when I met Juan. He was just there having coffee at the bar, and we struck up a conversation, and we found out we had a couple of mutual friends in common. And before you know it, he was in my bed.
By the way, this is a classic straight guy question. Did you know right away he was on your team?
I had a pretty solid idea. And that's not to say that it was obvious, but right. there is a vibe that that us gays do use to determine who is on our team and who is not. And I think in my head, I did believe he was on my team.
But that's interesting. You say that you guys can tell. I, as you know, I have no gaydar, never have, and I wouldn't have been able to tell with either one of you guys. I, you know, if I live right next door to you, I'd be probably wouldn't know. So it's interesting. All right, so I'm going to pivot here. We talked earlier about your old line. You want to keep your personal life personal, and for the most part, we have completely blown that up.
Yes,
I cannot think of anything that we won't talk about on the air, except for one thing, and I'll let you take this as little or as far as you want to go. You have become uncomfortable talking about the details of your lawsuit, so much so that you actually explained it all on a show, then did something you've never done before. You had them pull the podcast.
Yes.
I probably talked too much there. I want to pull that back. Why is this something that, for whatever reason, you want to keep to yourself?
Well, it's really complicated. I don't know if people fully understand it, what the lawsuit is. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, I owned a theater, the one I owned with Cranston out in Palm Desert. And the theater up the road blocked us from getting any movies. And they would use their size. You know, they've got 4,000 screens and I've got 9 or 10.
Mismatch.
And they're saying, look, if you play your movie with Mason, that means we're not going to play your movie at any of our 4,000 locations. So they were using something called circuit size, circuit power, to really pummel us. And litigation was the one way we would survive. The reason I don't talk about it, I think is because it's still on appeal.
Right.
It's still an active case. And
yeah, anything could be incorporated into the appeal.
Yeah. So I'm afraid if I say the wrong thing, and I have a pretty good feel. I got like a, a junior associate antitrust law degree going through this process. But I'm just afraid that I might say something that will show up in the appeal somehow. So I've laid low completely on the topic. And the other thing is, I'll be frank, in that, you know, I live a, would you say I live a modest life? I live a modest life.
I think you have a great respect for money, and it's because you didn't grow up with a lot of it. That's always been my theory.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I don't want, you know, I would say if I win the lottery, I won't do much different. I mean, I probably realistically would do some things different, but you know, I don't think I would ever go to living a fancy life. And when we're doing the show, I'm always thinking about, and I've been super blessed. We've had a great long run in radio with ESPN, and you know, I've had success in the theater business, and you've had success with the late. I always think, yeah, but there's a guy driving a truck in Pomona right now, and he's like, damn, those people have so much money. So I don't like talking about having a lot of stuff, only because I don't think that our average listener does. So I keep a lot of that stuff, a lot of the money stuff on the down low.
Yeah, no, totally understandable. Makes sense. Okay, so I want to end this with some quick hits. These are kind of going to bounce all over the place.
Okay.
Who is or was your biggest broadcast influence? You and I always talk about how radio is derivative. Who did you copy when you were younger, and who's the voice in your head?
The voice in my head is, I think it's Howard Stern. I think the voice in my head is Howard Stern. I think my sense of humor comes mostly from David Letterman. But I think in terms of, as a broadcaster, letting it all hang out and saying whatever you want and no holds barred, I think that comes from Stern.
Do you think you'll ever get married?
No.
Why?
I just don't want to do it. I'm not a big joiner. Just because everybody's doing it doesn't mean I want to do it. I mean, I'm glad that their marriage is okay now in the LGBTQ community, and that's fantastic. I've never thought it was for me, never thought it was necessary, and never planned to do it.
You travel more, well, pre-COVID, you traveled more than almost anyone I know. I'm sure you'll get back to it. Where is your favorite place?
My favorite place is, and it moves around quite a bit, my favorite place right now is Croatia.
Why?
Which we went to last summer. It is absolutely beautiful. It's on the Adriatic Sea, which is one of those bodies of water with an unbelievable amount of salt in it. So you just float. You just sort of bob up and down. Like, it would be impossible to drown in the Adriatic Sea because you can't go underwater because there's so much salt. So you float around. You swim around. You have great meals, unbelievable fish, the bluest ocean. I had the best time in Croatia, and that's probably my favorite place right now.
That surprises me. That's interesting. All right. What are you doing in 10 years, in 2030?
In 2030, well, I plan to work on the Olympics in 2026. 2028, yeah. And I intend to be fully shut down and just doing this podcast in 2030.
I hope so.
Yeah.
All right. Chinatown is your favorite movie. You talk about that a lot.
Yep.
What's number two?
Number two is Network, which
that's a great movie.
Yeah, we just got to see Bryan Cranston do it on Broadway. Peter Finch is crazy, mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. Faye Dunaway is so friggin' fantastic in that movie. Beatrice Strait, Patty Chayefsky. I talked to somebody that was once in that movie, and they said that Patty Chayefsky, who wrote the script, wrote the pauses in. So you weren't allowed to add your own pause anywhere. He would write or he would write pause, and you had to follow it word for word for word. I think that is that was a movie that saw the future. It's hyper stylized, really cool. holds up really well today. So Chinatown's number two. Or I'm sorry, Network's number two.
Network's number two. You know, it's interesting. I got to see, basically through my friendship with you, I got to see Cranston do that in New York a little bit before you did. And Aaron Sorkin was in the crowd that night, and he writes that way. He writes his pauses and everything. But you mentioned Paddy Chayefsky, and Cranston, the show's not running anymore, so I'm not ruining it for anybody. But Cranston had tipped me off that at the end of the show, there's an assassination, and the assassin is played by Chayefsky's grandson.
Wow. Did you know that? No, I had no idea.
Yeah, he was the guy sitting in the audience that shoots, you know, that commits the assassination at the end.
Wow.
Next time you talk to him, they did it on purpose. So they had a link to Chayefsky in the Network play. And Brian won a Tony for it. I'm not putting anything out there that people who saw it didn't know.
Yeah.
That was the most incredible performance by an actor I've ever seen in a play. And you know that I go to a lot of plays.
Yep.
But I mean, he breaks out in a full sweat two or three times. He cries, he yells, he whispers. I mean, every emotion you can have. Like, if I told you right now, break out in a full sweat, there's no way.
No.
I mean,
no.
I mean, and Brian was doing it, like, on command. They, like, when Howard Beale was going crazy, it really is. If he ever revives that performance.
Yes. Gotta see it.
To go see it.
Yeah.
Because it's staggering how good it is. Okay. This is a variation of a question I asked you a few weeks ago. I asked you, if you had 6 minutes to live, what song would you pick to hear on the way out? And you said Leonard Cohen, Hallelujah.
Yes.
Okay. So this is a variation of that. Somebody tells you you have 6 minutes to live and you get one phone call.
Ooh.
But you can only call one person. It can be one. It can be your mom. It can be your dog. It can be your brother. 6 minutes, one call. Who are you calling?
Well, it comes down to Juan and my mom. And I think it would probably be, I have 6 minutes to live, but the world's not ending.
The world is not ending. They're going on.
They're going on. I would probably make it my mom then. I would probably make it my mom. Just so that she would have some closure.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We lost our, we talked about this a lot of the show. We lost our dads within a few months of each other. And I in a lot of ways, I think this is true for you too. It has brought me much closer to my mom than I ever was before.
Yeah.
Because now we're kind of their person. I mean, I know your mom has not stepdad Leo, who seems like a great guy, but it's weird. It's like things you were afraid to tell your mom a long time ago, or maybe that you wouldn't take the time to tell her. Now you can do it. So
it's tricky. Weird. Do you feel like you're ever parenting your mom?
Sure. Yeah, I think we all, especially in your case, you told me you've been doing it since you were a teenager.
Yeah, no, I've been doing it a long time. Yeah, and part of that too is, my mom, my dad was just a hellacious hellraiser when I was growing up. And so we were incredibly close to my mom because we at times had to bond really. It's like, I don't know, what was your dad's, what did he do for a living? He worked.
He was a manufacturer's rep. Basically, he was a salesman for different companies his whole life. He would represent, like, there used to be a company called Certron who sold audio tape and tape recorders and stuff like that. He would go into businesses and into TV and radio stations and try and convince them to use Certron machines. So he was a manufacturer's rep right up until he retired, which was right before he died.
So my dad was a salesman for Eastman Kodak, but we never bothered to learn my dad's work phone number. We just had to know the number of the bar where he was hanging out at that point. And so my mom would say, go call your father at 9 o'clock at night. And so we dial 243-0120, the town club in downtown Toledo, and say, where's my dad? Dad, you've got to come home now. We had a really, we were all really bonded to my mom because we were all in that sort of dysfunctional alcoholic family, together. And my dad did straighten it out at the end and, you know, I love my dad and, you know, all that stuff. But it was, there were some rough times growing up. And I think because of all that, there would be words that need to be said, some resolution when I talk to my mom, if I had 6 minutes left.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Okay. So this last thing, the question I get asked a lot, and I'm sure you get it too, is how long are you going to do this? Or in another form, you know, we've had a ridiculous run in radio. If you get 5 years, that's good. If you get 10, you're in the top 5%.
Yep.
More than 10, especially in a market like New York or LA, and you're literally riding inside of a wave. And we've gotten 26.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've always said that and maybe it's a defense mechanism, but I always envision that the contract that we're in is the last one. I think, you know, this is probably the end, so just enjoy it. And then we'd somehow figure out a way to keep it going. How much longer do you think Mason and Ireland are going to last on the radio? Do you have any feel for that at all?
You know, I don't. I always assume that the current contract is the last contract.
That we both do.
And that, you know, and it one always magically pops up at the right time. I would imagine we've got, I'm guessing we've got one more deal after this one. What do you think?
Who knows? You know, in my case, I'm kind of navigating the Lakers and the radio station at the same time, which are kind of conflicting interests.
Yeah.
You and I talked about on your podcast, the Lakers like to control the message, and talk radio is the opposite of that.
Yep.
The talk radio is based in opinion. So that you know, is something that I've got to kind of always constantly measure. But we'll see. There's going to be, I don't know how much you and I can say. We probably can't say much. This is going to post. We're taping this on a Sunday. It's going to post on a Monday. There's going to be news, I would think, this week that there are changes coming to ESPN
good,
LA.
Good changes.
Which I was just going to say, I think are good for us.
Yep.
That would increase the chances that we stay. But even if we don't, we're in the middle of a 3-year contract and year two just started.
Yeah.
So, like, we're going away next month either way. There, you know, that would be too easy. That would be the big cushy buyout that we've always dreamed of, but we're never going to get.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we can just say that if you used to like our old time slot, you're going to love our new one.
Well, yeah, and it's something that you and I get now that we live in this world of social media. We get all the time, like, when are you guys, what happened to Mason and Ireland in the middle of the day? When are you guys, give us that back, blah, blah, blah. Well, you're going to get some good news coming up. That's probably as much as we are allowed to say.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The news is going to break soon. All right, so we've gone well over an hour.
Yep.
How do you think this went?
I think it went great. I mean, I learned a lot about myself because, you know, I don't keep necessarily the best track of what I'm doing at any given time. But no, I thought it was good. I thought you covered a lot of ground.
Yes. Well, as you know, I don't sleep. So when it was either last night or the night before, Reagan the dog woke up at 4 a.m. wanting food. And I said, okay, I've got the whole house to myself. Everyone else is asleep. And I wrote out probably 20 or 30 questions, and I think we covered all of them. I didn't know if we would get to all of them, but we did, which is the, by the way, which is the advantage of a podcast.
Yep.
All the things that we, why I'm kind of glad you're doing one, is that all these things we talked about, we probably won't bring up on the air. So if you took the time to listen to this and you're a loyal listener to the show, I think you learned a lot about you and I, particularly you, and maybe the thing I'm most happy with, I think the content in this hour is completely different than the content in the one you did with me.
Me too. Completely different conversation. Completely agree. Yeah. Yeah. No, it came out really, really good.
Okay, cool. All right, man. Well, I will, we have, oh, by the way, so I text you, you and I are texting the week, and you say, you pick the time, let's do it Sunday. And I write back to you, okay, great, let's do it at 3 o'clock. And 45 minutes ago, I got a text from you saying, call you at noon? What kind of Are you on East Coast time or something?
Yeah. No, I meant Eastern Standard Time. I kind of screwed that up. But you know, I have trouble keeping track of all this stuff.
All right, it all worked out. Do you have to close it?
I do. I'm gonna close it and say thank you very much for listening to the Culture Pop Podcast. John was great today. Don't forget the best thing you can do for me is to subscribe. Go to stevemason.com, and there's really clearly a button to subscribe on iTunes or to subscribe on Spotify. Thank you very much for listening. And John, thanks a lot, man.
You got it, man. Talk to you on the radio.
Okay, see you tomorrow.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.